I'm David Bank, and from Impact Alpha, this is an Agents of Impact podcast.
What we're seeing are also emerging markets leapfrogging developed markets like the United States and Europe.
That's Jacob Haar, co-founder and managing partner of Community Investment Management, an institutional impact investment manager that lends to technology-enabled, that is fintech, lenders. We spoke about how CIM took its approach from emerging markets to the U.S. and back again, as well as the COVID disruption and the current inflationary environment. Let's jump right into our conversation. Tell us how the business works.
So Community Investment Management, or CIM as we call it for short, is a private credit asset manager, institutional impact investment manager, so impact is at the core of everything that we do, that finances the innovative portfolios of various different financial technology or fintech companies that are out there trying to solve pain points for underserved borrowers that are lacking good access to responsible credit, but we believe have the capabilities and deserve to have better access to credit, both in the United States as well as in emerging markets.
Well, that's interesting. I remember when you were first getting going and we were chatting and you were telling me about your microfinance background and how you were going to bring some of that learning to the U.S. Now, I guess you're bringing some of the learning that you have in the U.S. Back to emerging markets.
Exactly. It's all coming full circle. So, I mean, I started my career working for Save the Children about 19 years ago in Azerbaijan, where we were making microloans to refugees that had come into the country with no credit history, were living in schools and other places in temporary housing, and were trying to figure out, you know, how to start businesses and build a livelihood for themselves and their families in a new country. And I think back then, when I was working on this microfinance institution lending to them, the realization, you know, for me, and I think many have had this who have worked on microfinance or come across financial inclusion, is just how powerful responsible credit can be for those who lack access to it, how transformative it can be. And, you know, in my mind, it's not rocket science. It's about engaging with people who deserve credit, don't have it, and ultimately trying to understand how to solve those pain points. In the beginning, microfinance days, a lot of that was brick and mortar models of just sending people out into motorbikes to go to open air markets and just engage with the customer and solve the problem, cash flow based underwriting, et cetera. And I got really interested when we started CIM with the same co-founder that I did the microfinance fund, Mike Hokinson. And we were looking at fintech in the US and how it was solving pain points for underserved small businesses left behind by consolidating bank sector and preyed upon by merchant cash advance and other really, really destructive and extractive forms of financing. And over the last 10 years that we've been funding fintech in the US, we've seen emerging markets, which were quite a bit behind with many of those innovations in fintech, digital infrastructure and other things, in some ways leapfrog even where the US is. And so super excited over the past couple of years to be working on funding those innovative fintech companies in emerging markets that are utilizing this, you know, digital transformation that we've seen in society and commerce, particularly accelerated by COVID, to reach all of these underserved folks with access to capital in a way that we haven't seen before. So it's pretty neat to see the emerging market microfinance and forming some of the fintech in the US and now spreading to fintech in emerging markets again.
Well, so you mentioned the digitalization that I think was vastly accelerated in the pandemic. How does that change sort of how, you know, lenders can find borrowers and how borrowers can find lenders, I guess, in both markets, in both here and elsewhere?
Yeah, and I think you all have talked about this some on Impact Alpha around, you know, the way that finance is becoming embedded within so many other, you know, types of commerce. So, for example, you know, if you look at a company like Toast in the United States, that is software for restaurants, Toast is offering capital because they have touch points to reach customers. They have tons of data to get information on those customers, real-time data. They have a flow of payments because people pay with digital payments via Toast. And so you can just deduct those payments from those payment flows, and they can run a fully digital operation instead of needing to have bank branches in communities all over America in order to work with a part of the market, restaurants that are tough businesses, you know, and really hard to lend to and not lose money. And yet they've found a great way to embed lending within that. And so what we're seeing is this digital infrastructure that is being built, for example, in a place like India, right? India, even in 2014, only had 270 million people who had internet access via their phones. And 6 years later, in the midst of COVID, 830 million people had access to the internet on their phones. So more than 560 million people over that 6 year period. And it's only now in the last 2-3 years accelerated further. And what that means is that people who used to, for example, operate a three-wheel taxi in India before were being paid with cash, and to the extent they were able to get financing, which was quite difficult, would have to be found, which is expensive to find that business owner. They have to somehow document enough information so that they could be underwritten. They would then have to go in person and make payments to service that loan. And they would have all of those interactions, which are very expensive when you're making small loans. Whereas today, because people are paying with Google Pay, for example, that three-wheeler, when they take a ride with a QR code, there's all this digital infrastructure where that person now can be reached digitally. There's all of the transaction information of everybody who paid them. There's a flow of payments that essentially can de-risk the likelihood that they don't pay, which means that they can be offered much better pricing. And the very expensive inefficiencies of servicing a small borrower like that can be dramatically reduced. And so all of that, what that means is that there's better yield for investors. There's a lower cost that can be received by that small business owner. And it's just creating dramatic efficiencies in that process.
Now, you talk about de-risking, and both in the sense of being able to tap the payment stream, but also in the information that you're getting around the business, or that your lenders are getting around the business of their customers. Does it turn out that there was mispriced risk in the market?
I think certainly there always is mispriced risk in the market. And so better information leads to better decisions, which leads to less people getting funded that shouldn't get funded, and you know, where the outcome might not be as good, which is better for everyone. But it also, there's a combination of improving our understanding of people so that we can truly segment risk and fund people who, you know, have great capabilities but have not been given opportunities, to be sure. But there's also a lot of this product innovation which helps lead to better outcomes, right? So if you rely on someone needing to go an hour away to a bank branch to make a payment, you're much more likely to get repaid if you are deducting those payments from the stream of cash flow that is going to them because they're being paid via these digital channels. And so, yes, it's about more accurately pricing risk, but it's also about creating products that are better for people that lead to better outcomes. So I think it's generally both. And it's why it's also so important that these digital tools have responsible practices built into them, because there's you can use digital infrastructure to build predatory products or build responsible products. And there's a lot of both. And so it's really incumbent on us as impact investors to figure out what are the models that we think are really innovative and creating more opportunity and better outcomes for customers, and ultimately are going to be the long-term winners, versus the models that are just some really innovative, nifty way of ripping people off better.
Well, how do you make that distinction between those different kinds of apps? One might actually look good on paper in terms of the returns, no?
Yeah, it's definitely not about returns. There's a lot of different frameworks that one uses when evaluating what responsible practices mean and what they look like. And we've done a lot of work on this in the United States, right? We were one of the co-authors of the Small Business Borrower Bill of Rights here in the U.S., which essentially codified these six fundamental rights about transparency, responsible underwriting, fair collection practices, et cetera, et cetera. And That's a framework that we use when looking at fintechs globally. You know, there's also, you want to make sure that there's not discriminatory practices or any sort of discrimination based into the algorithms or the way that things are being built and conducted. It's about pricing. And I would say, like, at its most fundamental, though, the key point is this capital productive capital? Meaning, can it be taken by the borrower and used to create an outcome that, after paying for the cost of that financing, is accretive to the financial health of that business or that individual household? Or is it taking ultimately value and wealth out of that business or out of that household because they're in desperate straits and they need the money, right? And that, I think, is the true distinction between a predatory product and a responsible product. There's a lot of subtlety and room for improvement across the board, but from our perspective, it's about engaging with companies, both evaluating them, but also capacity building and trying to build responsible companies. That's the future we want to live in. And so I think that that is a lot of the work that we do. And ultimately, what we're trying to do is scale and demonstrate those responsible products so that they are the ones that enter the financial mainstream. And the predatory extractive products just continue to do what they always do, which are exist, extract capital out of folks, but they're not great long-term companies because they don't benefit the end customer.
You mentioned digitalization as a trend that's made the business sort of easier and better able to function. There are other kinds of things that are going on, obviously, recently are, high inflation rate and then concomitant, now higher interest rates. So how are those affecting your business, both as a lender, but then also how are your borrowers or the companies you're funding and their borrowers getting affected?
Inflation rates have presented a challenge. To especially in emerging markets, but also in the United States for folks who are living on the margin. So, what we've seen so far is that generally income or revenue has not necessarily been impacted globally. Even in this rising interest rate environment, inflation, et cetera, individuals are actually still making good money. And in fact, labor costs have been going up. Small businesses are continuing to sell and have good volumes. The real challenge has been on the cost side of the equation, right? Costs because of inflation have gone up. So for folks who are living paycheck to paycheck or barely making ends meet every month, their costs have gone up and their income has not gone up at the same level. And so that has definitely put a squeeze, especially in the lower income segments of the market. Across the board. And it's more so, for example, in Latin America than it is even in the United States. In the United States, you see it with the lower income segments, but the higher income segments, you don't see being impacted in the same way. So I think that many of us have been concerned and thinking about all the macroeconomic headwinds, but we have not yet seen loss rates or loss of income or things similar to what happened, for example, in 2008. Show up in the current time, but I think we're all being vigilant to look at the future and try to understand what might be around the corner. Interest rates is another element though. And so I think it's a really important element. So for a fund like ours, interest rates mean if we charge floating interest rates, our returns generally go up, right? The challenge with that, however, is that means that the fintech companies and the end borrowers are ultimately having to bear the cost of this higher interest rate environment, which we are in. And especially if we do see higher loss rates, that puts pressure on many of the lenders and borrowers that are out there to have the economics work when costs are higher, losses may be higher in the future, and for example, cost of hedging and things like that may also be higher. So it's a tougher environment to navigate because of those pressures on profitability.
Well, and so does that mean that some loans are not getting made, or that underwriting is tightening up, or it's, and so therefore some businesses that might have gotten financed, in an earlier period are now going to not get financed, or some projects won't get financed?
Yes, certainly there are businesses that will. Financing is not easy for them to get today, and equity certainly is not easy for them to get today. I think I see more businesses struggle to get equity or venture capital then I see businesses struggle to get debt in today's environment. But I do think that between higher interest rates, macroeconomic headwinds, and this recent Silicon Valley Bank and other bank concerns, you are seeing lending contract somewhat, and it is much harder for folks to get that capital. Now, in the segments that we, the end borrowers that we ultimately, our capital is flowing down to, the incremental cost of that is a result of this interest rate increase is not that large compared to the overall costs of the capital to them to account for losses and all of these things. So I would say that the cost for the underlying borrower is not dramatically higher. But when you look at, for example, fintech startups or any startups that are out there right now, harder to raise equity, financing is more expensive, some potential concerns about the macroeconomic environment and performance. So there definitely is a lot more risk and I think concerns out there that folks need to navigate. And that's where, you know, I do think that in the current environment, there's a great need and opportunity for folks like us who are lending. At the same time, I do see that there's a lot more risk out there that one needs to navigate through. And so, you know, it's a multifaceted environment, but one in which there's a great need for impact investors to step up. And I think a lot of opportunity for impact investors that are being thoughtful about risk too.
You mentioned the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, and that obviously sent a shudder through the sort of ecosystem. But you have always operated in a sort of place where the banks either no longer go or don't yet go, depending on your perspective. So how goes the disruption of the banking sector?
Well, end borrowers are, you know, the various different small businesses that we finance. Many of them have not been banked anyway by that banking sector, but it certainly is harder for credit to flow in that current environment. I think that, you know, what's a little bit remains to be seen is what will the failure of Silicon Valley Bank do in terms of startups being able to get venture debt, right? Which essentially is a lot of the debt that Silicon Valley Bank provided, which essentially extended the runway of those startups in partnership with the venture capital funds. That's not the business that CIM is in, for example. Our business is more about helping to finance the portfolios of those fintechs. And so it hasn't particularly changed our world, but I think many of us who are involved in the startup or technology space are, you know, interested in seeing if other, especially non-bank lenders, are going to come into that space to fill the void that Silicon Valley Bank left, or if this is truly going to create a much more difficult environment for those startups and companies to get financing in an environment where already it's much harder for them because of the equity financing being harder too.
And finally, just as in the macro, you mentioned the sort of rising costs of hedging, currency risk, and other kinds of things that might affect, emerging markets. And in general, sort of how are you seeing the climate for both investing and lending in emerging markets as, you know, as you said, the choppy macro headwinds play out?
Well, certainly emerging market investing is not for folks that have not spent years of their lives doing it already, I would say. And this would maybe not be the market for inexperienced funders to rush into emerging markets. That said, the opportunity that exists today because of some fundamental shifts in the way that underlying creditworthy customers are able to be reached, understood, lent to without as much risk, it's very compelling. And that is, you know, there has been hundreds of millions of dollars that has flowed into many of these fintech companies overseas, a number of whom are sitting on, you know, $100 million plus in cash and have the ability now in a challenging market to build short duration portfolios that will be solving many pain points for these underlying customers. So I think there's a combination of recognizing that we're in an environment that you have to be very cautious in terms of risk, but also seeing the massive opportunity that's out there to fund and scale these businesses and generate very compelling impact for people who, you know, if you believe that I do, the capabilities are equally distributed, but opportunities certainly are not. That's a great market inefficiency that needs to be solved. And we have the tools to solve it. And it's great to see impact investors, I think, get involved, provide that financing, guide that industry to really try to put a dent in much of the income inequality, which we've seen worsen over the last decade plus.
So both a cautious environment, but also an opportunity, I think, to come through it maybe with even a stronger financing ecosystem. Is that right?
I think that's right. And I think that what we're seeing are also emerging markets leapfrogging developed markets like the United States and Europe, right? Just like we had with cell phone communications, where, you know, in the US and other developed markets, we slowly, incrementally went from the telegraph to, you know, the landline to fax machines to cell phones, et cetera, right? Smartphones. In emerging markets, you know, there were places where there was really no landline communication, nothing, and folks went almost immediately to cell phones and smartphones. And that same leapfrogging is what we're seeing around financial services, which means that there is now infrastructure to reach people that have not had that type of access before in a dramatic way. And the types of businesses that are now being built on that infrastructure, which has been laid over the past decade in emerging markets, is at a really unique moment. And so I think there'll be some incredible businesses that are being built that have the potential to transform the financial access for many customers. And I think the ultimate question is, will that generate impact or will that wreak damage? And, you know, I'll give a little bit of a spoiler in my opinion, which is it'll do both. So it's a question of what are we going to do? Where are you going to get involved and where are you going to try to direct it towards positive impact?
Terrific. Well, thank you, Jacob Harv, Community Investment Managers, for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much, David. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
That's going to do it for this Agents of Impact podcast. You can read more about Jacob Harr, Community Investment Management, and Small Business Lending at ImpactAlpha.com. Big thanks to Jacob, to our producer Isaac Silk, and to the whole team at Impact Alpha, Investment News for a Sustainable Edge. And to all you Agents of Impact, thanks again for all that you do.